Welcome to Podcast One. We hope you'll support our sponsors who bring you these podcasts absolutely free and with limited interruptions. And of course, we appreciate you listening to this show, which will get started in just a second.
Spectrum One is a big deal. You get Spectrum Internet with the most reliable internet speeds, free advanced Wi-Fi for enhanced security and privacy, and a free Spectrum Mobile Unlimited line with nationwide 5G included, all while saving big. For the big speed, big reliability, and big savings you want, get Spectrum One. Just $49.99 a month for 12 months. Visit spectrum.com/bigdeal for full details. Offer subject to change. Valid for qualified residential customers only. Service not available in all areas. Restrictions apply.
Sometimes it takes a different approach to help you unlock your true potential. With Capella University's game-changing FlexPath learning format, you gain relevant skills you can apply to your career right away. Earn your degree from an accredited university and be confident in the quality of your education. Imagine your future differently at capella.edu. Capella University is accredited by the Higher Learning Commission. Learn more at capella.edu/accreditation.
Author Brian Kaufman is curriculum editor for an online junior college. He has published 4 novels, 2 textbooks, and a number of novellas. He lives with his wife and dog in the Colorado mountains, avoiding, as he says, moderation and any pretense of maturity. Kaufman's sports romance novel, The Fat Lady's Low Sad Song, which earns a Kirkus star, follows an aging minor league player who joins a team that just hired a female pitcher. Our reviewer calls it an entertaining, sweetly atmospheric baseball story. In this sponsored interview, we talk with Brian about his book. Brian, welcome to Fully Booked.
Thank you.
What are the critical elements of a great baseball book?
For me, the most important thing is that it not be all about baseball.
Right.
I think that the book has to cover other aspects. I chose the sport beyond just my love of the sport, my unrequited love. I was a terrible player. I chose the sport because it's a nostalgic, mm-hmm. which fit the tone of the book. It happens a little bit at a time over a long period of time, kind of like life. Mm-hmm. And I hate to go back to that metaphor, but it is very much like life. And mm-hmm. so I was able to explore relationships, communities, team building, things like that within the sport.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not just about baseball.
Fantastic. And what drew your interest to the minor leagues?
The minor leagues is where hearts get broken. Ball players with dreams go there and they don't attain their goal. And they have to figure out what they're going to do next.
Right.
And they have to figure out how to enter real life. And in the meantime, they're given their all. Mm-hmm. And they're chasing something important to them. Sometimes the major leagues, those guys get a little too much money and a little too much ego, and
uh-huh.
then it's just not as fun.
Right. And why a female pitcher?
It's an idea I've been thinking about for a long time because I think it's going to happen someday.
Right.
The idea of a female knuckleball pitcher is not far-fetched.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, in Colorado, we had the professional women's baseball team, and they hired Phil Niekro, the great knuckleball pitcher, as the coach. And I thought, oh, my God, he's going to teach one of these girls to throw the knuckler, and my book's going to be done in before I even write it.
And what are some of your other novels about?
My first novel was a historical novel. My next novel, which will be coming out in another year, is a historical about the Civil War. Mm-hmm. In the meantime, I wrote about zombie apocalypse.
Great.
Because I like zombies.
Do you have a favorite zombie book?
Mine. I was lucky. I got ahead of the curve on the zombie craze, and my book came out just as that was happening. And perhaps it's outdated now, but it's a good book.
And the title?
Dead Beyond the Fence from Dark Silo Press.
All right. Well, Brian, thanks so much for talking with us about your book. If you're just joining the podcast, you can find The Fat Lady's Low Sad Song at online retailers and select independent bookstores.
Podcast One presents Fully Booked by Kirkus Reviews, the ultimate insider's scoop on the best new books. Every week, Kirkus brings you author interviews, recommendations from the bestseller lists, and insights into books that are not yet on your radar.
Hi, I'm Clay Smith. I'm the editor of Kirkus Reviews.
And I'm Megan Labrice. I'm the staff writer.
And today we're really excited to be talking to Glory Adam. She is the editor of a great new anthology called Well-Read Black Girl. Not only is she the editor of this anthology, which has essays by Jesmyn Ward and Tayari Jones and a bunch of other great African-American playwrights and thinkers and writers, but she created Well-Read Black Girl, which is a sort of online book club that took off because of her savvy and her drive. So we are all thankful for this new book.
Yeah, and the story of how it got off the ground and how it changed into the form we now know it in today is really fascinating. So I look forward to hearing her share that soon.
Yeah. Well, let's call her up.
Let's do it.
The story in the intro to this book is so fascinating. So Well-Read Black Girl started out with a t-shirt. Is that right?
Yeah, it was really a t-shirt. It was a gift from my boyfriend.
And tell us a little bit about that t-shirt, because it must have been quite a t-shirt to get Well-Read Black Girl started.
Well, you know, I've told this story so many times, but the part of it that really made it special is just my boyfriend. He's just like incredibly thoughtful, and he does a lot of small like gifts and, you know, surprises for me. And this shirt was for my birthday, and he had that nickname for me. You know, I was like his Well-Read Black Girl, and he has a bunch of silly names for me. I have an afro, so sometimes he calls me Puff. And so, you know, this is like one of the things he did that I really didn't think too much of it. It wasn't until I started wearing the shirt in public, and it started really being the catalyst to all these really like amazing conversations. Mm-hmm. So I would be, you know, at the grocery store or at the gym or just like on the subway in New York. And, you know, we're always in close proximity to one another. So women would come up to me and be like, where'd you get your shirt from? Or, you know, what does that mean? Or, you know, like they would just be so curious about it. And at first I kind of like stumbled through the beginning conversations like, oh yeah, my boyfriend made this for me, you know, like no big deal. But then when we started talking about books and people would like pull books out of their backpacks or their tote bags, like, oh, I'm reading this. Like, what are you reading? It really started to be something that I wanted to like really build upon, but really the beginnings are just like, it's just as simple as that. It was like a birthday gift from my delightful boyfriend, and it had the, you know, the words Well-Read Black Girl on it.
The Genesis story I love so much because I happen to be a fan and friend of Naomi Jackson is the first meeting where y'all got together to discuss the star site of Bird Hill. And it just seemed like so organic and friendly and community building and, you know, casual, but with purpose.
Right. I mean, so from the time I got the shirt, like I've actually created like a small timeline in my head. So my birthday is in December, December 22nd. So I really didn't do the book club or any kind of social media things until the following spring.
Yeah.
It was like kind of an idea that I was like sitting with, and my background is in strategy and is in marketing. So I'm for my day job, I was constantly on social media, and I interact with like Twitter and Facebook pretty often, personal and professionally. So mm-hmm. I kind of sat with the idea and played around with it with a couple of friends, and they're like, yeah, we should totally start a book club amongst ourselves, you know, through group text. And I didn't really do the book club until maybe that following spring. I want to say it was like that May. And so I posted the, you know, the image of the shirt on Instagram, and that post probably got like maybe 40 likes, you know, maybe 50, you know.
And I'm going to go back and like it right now.
It was really, really like simple. And the art direction I had for, if you even want to call it art direction, I really was trying to give it a vibe that felt very like nostalgic. And I wanted it, I used to do that like over saturated filter.
Right.
And so, like in my mind, I thought that would kind of like, you know, conjure the feeling of being in a library catalog and opening a book where you see like the yellowed pages, you know. I was trying to find like this balance of like holding a book, you know, but you know, we're online, so it's different. It's texture, it's technology, it feels different. But I did want to kind of put forth this feeling of like discovering an author, discovering a new book, but you're doing it on Instagram instead of your like local library. Yeah, so there's a lot of things like I played around with. I used to do quotes and I used to make these like little images in the very beginning. And I was just trying to like figure out how I wanted to use the medium. And then during that time, I also like launched the book club. That was like, to be quite honest, super informal. It was a bunch of my girlfriends. It was the first book club before Naomi was like a test book club, I like to call it. Mm-hmm. And we read Ta-Nehisi Coates' book, Between the World and Me. Mm-hmm. And that group actually had men and women in it. And one of my dear friends, Misa, she came with her boyfriend at the time, who's now her husband. And like, you know, we were all just in there. My friend Jessica came. We all like were just talking about the book, and we had such a wonderful time that I was like, okay, I want to do this again. So the next book I started to read was Naomi's book. Yeah. And I bumped into her at, well, not bumped into her. I went to her book signing. I went to her book signing at Greenlight, and I had a couple of more posts then and maybe 100 followers when I first met Naomi. And I showed her my Instagram and I told her that we were reading her book and invited her to come to the book club. And so that was, again, if I'm like thinking of the timeline, that was over the summer. So maybe we met in July or August, and then she came to the book club in September. And at that book club meeting, it was about 10 women. After reading her book, it's such a beautiful coming of age story that like, I kind of decided I wanted it to be more focused on Black women writers. And I also knew that this was Naomi's first book. And I just was so impressed with her writing and her craft and just her personality. She's like such a warm, like very gracious person. So when she's like accepted my invitation, I always give so much like love and support to Naomi, because her yes was really like made this possible. What makes the community so special is having the author present and, you know, really vibing with us and talking and answering questions. And I don't know if Naomi, if she had said no that day, this might not have been the movement that we have today. I might not have had this anthology, but because she said yes, it really spurred something really beautiful. Yeah. And you know what? I had like two authors for the price of one, because Natalie Diaz also came to that book club meeting.
Oh, recent Genius Grant Award winner, poet Natalie Diaz. Well done.
Yeah. She was like, yeah, my friend Natalie's going to come. Do you mind? I'm like, yeah, sure. And and at that time I wasn't familiar with Natalie's poetry. I just like was like, you know, two amazing people in the room with us enjoying enjoying the book and talking about the book. So it's really, when I think back and I think all the connections and the beautiful things that have happened over the years, I have come to the conclusion of this wonderful like anthology. I'm just like, I feel so grateful, and I could have never predicted it.
And so Well Read Black Girl, the book, is this wonderful anthology of various writers who you admire. You know, some of them talk about their first childhood interactions with books. Some of them don't talk about that. There's a whole variety of subjects here. Tell us a little bit about who's included and how did you choose? Because that it must have been tough to narrow it down.
Oh, completely. I mean, this book could be like 600 pages long. it just could go on and on and on. I knew that I wanted to have voices that were varied in different ways. So intergenerational, different life experiences, just coming at all access points. So we have like iconic women like Jesmyn Ward and Jacqueline Woodson and Tiare Jones. But we also have women in this anthology where this is their first time actually being published. So Carla Bruce Ennings, this is her first publication, as well as Bisrat Misgebi, who's a dear friend of mine, a phenomenal writer, but I've known her since childhood. So I was excited to invite everyone that I felt could just add a piece of themselves to this. And even when I came to this question, like the big question is like, when did you first see yourself in literature? I knew that everyone would have such a beautiful and varied origin story. You know, Tiare talks about for her, like she grew up in Atlanta, and being Black was like something that was just like beautiful and accepted and very like heartening. It wasn't something she needed affirmation for. So when she was telling her, writing her essay, it was more about digging deeper and looking at analysis and figuring out how sisterhood is built upon literature. But then you have activist Barbara Smith, who her story is different because she comes from a different generation. And her example or the role model she brings forth is James Baldwin. And she talks about going to James Baldwin's funeral, which I was just kind of so in awe of. When I was reading her story, I was like, this is unbelievable that I have this memory in this book, you know, something that shaped her life so profoundly and helped her find her own voice and craft her own narrative. And she shares it here. And so everyone has a sense of just genuine honesty and just genuine, spirit. There's a spirit in every story. And I wanted to capture this feeling of listening to your best friend. And that's the experience you have when you come to the book club. It is very intimate. We're talking amongst each other. We're talking about the characters, of course, but there's so much talk just about our everyday lives and the things that we experience as Black women and how we can be inspirations to one another and cheer each other on. So when I was curating this, I wanted to just evoke that feeling. And I also wanted there people to realize that there's just there's not one way to be a Black woman. There's not one way to be a Black girl. And our stories, it deserves to have that that attention and that light to be shined. Is that word shined? Is that the word? To be you know what I mean? I want to shine a light on everyone's voice. It was exciting to put together because most of it was very much my reading style. It felt just very intuitive. Mm-hmm. Oh, this feels right here. This goes here. It was just a flow. I literally laid out all the essays on the floor and just kind of put it together like a puzzle.
Yeah, it's so cool. And there are little threads between the entries. I see kind of where you made a few little moves, they are all in conversation with one another, a marvelous book group. And for me as your reader, it was such a privilege to feel I was sitting among all of these thoughtful Black women telling me about their experiences, where they're coming from as a reader, what they're looking for. And you kind of feel if you were in that book group that you would know oh, she's not going to like this next selection, or, oh, we're going to, we're going to need extra wine this night. You know what I mean? That's what it felt like. So
I'm so glad that came across because that is exactly what I was striving for. I wanted the conversations and the essays to be talking to one another. And I wanted to really speak to the reader and for them to see themselves in the authors and the contributors. So I'm glad that came across.
Oh, yeah. And the first thing I wanted to do, there are all these great lists for further reading in this book. But also, going back to what you mentioned about Barbara Smith, who wrote about attending James Baldwin's funeral, and she wrote a piece after that, We Must Always Bury Our Dead Twice. That's the very next thing I want to read. I want to know what she says.
Right. That was so important for me to include these reading recommendations as part of the book, because I wanted us to have that extra step. So you read the essay and you immediately want to go to JSTOR and look up the articles. You want to go to your local library. You want to go into an archive and find more about the authors and their lives and the recommendations they give. I mean, there were so many books that I was completely surprised by, but Jasmine, so her story, she writes about witches. How fantastic is that? And N.K. Jemisin continues to dig deeper into African mythology and the myths that we tell ourselves and what it means to write your own story. There's so many things that you can just learn and reimagine what the literary canon can be and what it should be. So whether you're a young woman who's picking up this book, a young Black woman who's excited by it, or if you're a young man, or if you're a white man, a white woman, everyone in between can pick this up, and it could be something they could hold on to and explore more and figure out how to just expand their own personal libraries. And that was really important for me to include a list of playwrights, to include books on Black feminism, books that, discuss coming of age stories. I wanted to have a whole section just like dedicated to all these wonderful books that exist on my personal library that I found on, you know, on my syllabus when I attended Howard University. I just wanted all of that to serve as a major inspiration.
You know, so, I mean, you've got so many great contributors. You mentioned Tyree Jones and Jesmyn Ward. Morgan Jerkins is in here. I liked her essay.
Oh, wow.
So we're not going to put you on the spot and make you say your favorite, because I know that would be so painful. But you do write that you were fortunate to inherit the words of Maya Angelou at the perfect time in my life. That's your quote. And so I just, could you just say a little bit more about what you mean by that?
Well, you know, I think there are so many books that you read again and again, and each time in your life when you read them, they do something different for you. And the first time I read Maya Angelou, I didn't realize the profound impact it would have on my life. And I fumbled through it the first time. And I don't think it's an accident that I ended up teaching at a school named after her. You know, I really think like the universe places you in situations and like it's like calling you towards your future. So when I read it the second time when I was older, when I was like really like seeking myself and looking like for words and examples of what Black womanhood should be, like she like entered my life, as I said, at the perfect time, because I just needed something to believe in. You know, my mother at one point was like very, very ill. And there were times I wasn't able to talk to her about certain things. And I really like relied on books to serve as my mother's voice. And what Maya Angelou sounds like to me, she sounds like my mom. She sounds like an aunt, you know, like an elder in my family that's like giving me instruction and saying like, maybe you shouldn't do that. Yeah. You know what I mean? Like, and when you hear, and at that time, I don't think I had really listened to any audio of her. Like I just like read her books and I loved how like the dialogue was written where it just sounds familiar and it's not, for lack of a better word, it's not overly academic. It just sounds like how people talk, you know? I had an appreciation for that. I think anytime I read stories, dialogue is like my favorite part. Like I love hearing like accents. I love when things have just like a richness to them. Mm-hmm. And that was the first time I had read a book that like it really hit me in that way where like, oh, this sounds like someone that I know. And that's what it was. And so, I mean, I've read all of her books. I've read, you know, I have all her like works of poetry. I remember seeing her when she was doing the presidential inauguration and just went on TV, not in person. and she just is like the voice that like sits in my head that sounds like motherly. And now that she's passed, like it just sounds godlike. Like I imagine when, you know, and when I pass into another world, like I hope I hear Maya Angelou's voice. And that might sound like a little dramatic, but it just, that feels like very real to me.
Well, it's, I mean, gosh, such a distinctive voice, especially to have her talking as your mother in your head.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
No, she's so wonderful.
But there's like, it's so many, I feel like so many books and can do that for you, just offer like a level of like comfort and just when you see them, you know. And actually I'm turning 35 soon, and I'm like, I should like reread it for my 35th birthday, you know what I mean? Like I should just keep going.
Yeah.
I'm just trying in a split second recall of which one of the authors in this anthology said something like that. Like she reread a book and she was one character and then she was the next character and then she was the other character. Oh,
well, so many people did like reference that, but I recall Nottage talks about that too.
Yeah.
She read The Color Purple, mm-hmm. you know, she read it before she became a mother.
Yeah.
And she had a completely new understanding when she entered motherhood, when she had her daughter. So yeah, I think that's really important to kind of sit with text in a different way as you age. And Tiare Jones, she says the same thing when she read Tar Baby as a teenager, she was a little bit snarky and maybe a little bit like more relentless with Toni Morrison. And as she grew older, she understood the choices Morrison made in writing that book. You know, it's a really eye-opening thing to read things at different stages of your life.
Yeah. And it's also interesting because, you know, we just, you know, face value think of reading as like a solitary activity. But if this anthology drove anything home for me, it's that, you know, like really these books are bringing readers into a whole continuum of thinkers, lovers, dreamers, artists, you know, and showing the richness of that and the legacy.
Right. Exactly. And that was my only wish. Like, as I was writing this book, as I was like inviting contributors, I really returned again and again to Toni K. Bambara, Zora Neale Hurston, Alice Walker, Mari Evans. Like, all these women sit on my bookshelf, and I read them continuously when I was in college. And especially Toni K. Bambara, you know, her book, she's like the queen of the first anthology. Her book was called The Black Woman. And it was such a major inspiration for me. At that time when she wrote that book, like Nikki Giovanni was featured, Abby Lincoln, Alice Walker. And it was like very much their early works before they became the women we know them to be. And I wanted to also capture that feeling where we are watching a new literary movement happen, and we're capturing all these new voices, and who knows what their careers will be in the next decade, you know, in the next two decades, who knows who they will be and what they will write and what impact they will have in the world. And to capture that early feeling. And I feel very fortunate to be able to read and connect with so many wonderful women who are immensely talented. And I'm like really proud to be able to like have them all in this book.
So you mentioned, you know, some of the essays being eye-opening, and I'm guessing you gave pretty, you know, open directions to your contributors about what they could write about. But did any of the essays when they came in really surprise you in a pleasant way?
Yeah, well, I really loved Bistrat Biskebi's essay, how she talks about Dahl and how reading his work. Because I recall like reading James and the Giant Peach, like I loved reading that book, and how his experience and his life really helps her understand her immigrant parents. Both her parents are Eritrean. They grew up in areas that were they had a lot of traumatic events happen to them. And as she like tells the story, she talks about how Dahl had very traumatic experiences happen to him. So he apparently had a daughter who passed away. His father like had one arm. Like she tells like all these like really surprising facts about him that I was completely unaware of. But for her as a child to help, it had helped her comprehend what trauma was like and how sometimes you have like secrets in your family or things you don't talk about, and encourage her to become a writer in order to like uncover those hidden secrets. So I was very surprised by that essay, and I loved how she put that together. It was like beautifully done. I also loved Veronica Chambers' essay when she talks about Jamaica Kincaid and how she was coming into her own, deciding to become a writer. But something about reading Jamaica Kincaid's essay in The New Yorker made her realize that whatever life that she would have, you know, now she's a writer for The New York Times. But if that did not happen, she would be okay with it. And I thought it was just like such a profound statement that like she is a writer through and through, whether she is like writing on a small island by herself or writing in one of like the top publications in the world, she's a writer. And I thought that was like really great. And, you know, I love Jamaican Cake Girl is one of my favorite stories. But yeah, like the choices that the contributors made were really great and they did surprise me. And I also knew a lot of people would be paying tribute to the Queen Mother, Toni Morrison.
Yes.
And, you know, like every essay, there is like such a like a beautiful nod to her legacy. But even still, I was surprised on how those, you know, chapters came through or how those stories came through with even Tiari. Like I loved how she kind of pushed back and said, I was mad at Mother Toni. Mm-hmm. You know, she really does push back. But it's great. It's great to see how she's is so interwoven into the lives of Black women, from The Bluest Eye to Mercy to Sula. Like it is, she is forever going to be like the Queen Mother, and it's so beautiful to pay tribute to her in this book too.
So we have Well-Read Black Girl, the anthology. You had the festival. You have the book club. You have the Instagram. You won the Innovators Award at the LA Festival of Books. I was there.
Oh, yay.
Yeah, cheering for you. are you still a one-woman operation?
I am. I am. Mm. It's me behind the screen, behind the Instagram, but I've now changed my mantra a little bit where initially when I decided to go at this full time, I was like saying, I'm an entrepreneur. This is becoming a business. And then you sit down and you write a book and you sit with it. And I have come to the conclusion I am more of an artist than an entrepreneur.
Right.
And I also realize I like to take my time and sit with things and just wonder about them and like make a little bit of a mess. And that's not necessarily how you run a business.
Right.
So I'm learning these things about myself and I'm realizing more and more that I want this to be community driven. And I'm more concerned about that and less about an IPO, you know, like this,
right.
this is not a startup by any means. This is just me building a community, that will grow and have a legacy. And I would be really happy if someone named a library after me.
Well, I personally want you to have your own imprint.
Yes, say that again.
I want you to have your own imprint.
I would love that. Like that feels like more of the direction that I, especially after doing that anthology, it was just such a wonderful experience. Challenging to, you know, like not to make a light of it at all, but like it just felt like what I was supposed to be doing. And so I've just shifted my energy and just like my own mantra to think, how can I continue to grow this creative community? How can it like continue to help women and young girls and allow people to have their work published, you know, because at the end of the day, that's what we want. Like we want more and more Black women and people of color to have bodies of work in the world and have their books purchased and sold and on New York Times bestseller list, all that good stuff. So I've kind of like been, reshifting and things in my mind. And I have like a lot of ideas that I'm just like working through. But I work with a lot of wonderful committees. So even though it's me doing the running the Instagram and stuff, I do have like a wonderful partner that I work for helping me do the festival. I have an advisory committee that I work with closely. I mean, I'm very pleased with my team here at Ballantine. Like the publisher, Cara, is amazing. My editor, Emily, is amazing. I'm surrounded by a lot of wonderful people that want to help me succeed. So it's kind of like I'm not that alone. You know, I'm like holding hands in a circle and like we're figuring it out.
Well, the book is Well-Read Black Girl, an anthology by Glory Edom, and it is out now. And Glory, we love talking to you, so thanks for your time.
Thank you so much. This has been so, so amazing. I love you guys. It's such an honor to be on the podcast, so thank you for having me.
Yeah.
We love you, Glory. Thank you. Thank you so much.
What a fascinating anthology. It's just so impressive, all the names that are in there. Jesmyn Ward, Tyeri Jones. It's just such a timely, wonderful book.
Yeah, and each one of these authors is really giving of herself. Like one of the notes that's sounded throughout the book is that of being vulnerable. And I feel like, you know, they really present themselves in a vulnerable way as, you know, young readers, early readers, how they first, you know, when they first saw themselves in literature. And it's pretty powerful. Like, I think that this is a great anthology for anyone to read.
Yeah, because it takes you in surprising directions, you know. That's why I was asking her about that. So it just, it is eye-opening, as she said, it sort of goes in directions you don't expect, which is a pretty lovely thing.
Yeah, it's just really thoughtful and thorough, and as she was mentioning, it has different lists for continued reading, you know, poets and playwrights and sci-fi, you know, everything.
Yeah. And as a media outlet that is constantly producing lists of books that people should be reading, that is harder to do than it seems. So hats off to her.
Yes, indeed. Lists are hard to write, but hopefully they're a little easier to read because we're joined now in this sponsored segment by Andrew Chance, director of Spokane Public Library in southeastern Washington State, to read our latest book list. I'm really excited to speak with you again, Andrew, as the executive director of Spokane Public Library, because I think that your library is really unique and really at the forefront of creative community outreach. And I was wondering if you would tell our listeners just about a few of the cool things your librarians are doing.
Well, one of the things that we're doing right now, and we're actually just getting ready for this tomorrow, is a late night talk show that we've been doing for the past year. We feature really great community members doing cool things in the community. We'll have the lady from Sit and Be Fit show on public television on, and she'll be telling her about, you know, her experience out there in the community. We have artists, we have musical guests, and comedians, and it really attracts a different audience than the library has been able to traditionally attract, which is that 21 to 35-year-old crowd.
And do you hold it at one of the libraries in Spokane?
Yeah, we hold it at our downtown library. We cleared out our third floor and built a stage that overlooks the Spokane Falls. And it's really the best view in town. And what a great backdrop to show off and showcase Spokane.
And maybe it's too soon, but are you finding that the crowds for the late night show are converting to library users and checking out books, or is that even really the goal?
It's not really the goal. I mean, I think it's a side goal. I think more our goal is really to make those connections within the community and to let the community know that the library is a platform for them. It's not just our books and resources, but everything else that we have to offer.
But it is books, too, and also offered in a kind of cool new way. Please tell us a little bit about the West Central Kiosk.
So we just launched this earlier this summer, and this is a 24-hour-a-day, 7-day-a-week way for the community to access our materials. And we partnered with the West Central Community Center, where we did not have a presence in the community, and folks can check out items. It serves as a Wi-Fi hotspot, and you know they don't have to meet us when the library hours traditionally occur. You know, many folks have multiple jobs, and the traditional library hours don't suit those needs.
So it's basically like a big vending machine of books.
Yeah, it's like a big red box. Yeah.
Yeah. So is it unlike a potato chip vending machine? I'm hoping the books don't get stuck and you don't have to pound it.
No, we haven't had problems with that yet.
Okay.
I don't think we would. It's very well built. What's also cool is that people can request items be sent there. So if it's not available within the machine, you know, it can serve as a 24/7 holds pickup location for the library.
Can you drive it from Spokane to my house?
Not yet. You know, technology is getting smaller and smaller every day, so we'll see about that in the future.
Yeah. All righty. Well, we were talking about lists earlier, and we wanted to ask you to read a list of books that we recently published. What's the title of that list?
It's 9 must-reads to add to your library.
Well, we hope Spokane Library has all of these. I'm sure you do.
We do. I checked.
So that's great. Why don't you tell us 9 to 1 what they are?
All right. Well, 9, we have Transcription by Kate Atkinson. For 8 is These Truths, A History of the United States by Jill Lepore. 7 is There, There by Tommy Orange, which looks really interesting. 6, An American Marriage by Tayari Jones. 5, we have Safe Houses by Dan Fesperman. 4 is Patriot 1, American Dreams in Chinatown by Lauren Hilgers. 3, we have Asymmetry by Lisa Halliday. 2 is The Stranger Game by Peter Gadol. And 1, we have Frederick Douglass, Prophet of Freedom by David W. Blight.
Yeah, that's a brand new biography that is pretty hefty, but that our critics loved. So so now that we know that you have all these books in your library, we're going to call you, we'll give you like a month. We're going to call you up and ask you for an exegesis on every single one.
I might be able to get to two. So the two on my top list is There, There by Tommy Orange and These Truths, A History of the United States by Jill.
Both. Excellent, excellent choices.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, we had Jill Lepore on a previous podcast episode. It was really fascinating talking to her.
Yeah, they both look great.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much, Andrew, and congrats on the success of everything that's happening at the Spokane Public Library and all the creative community engagement you are doing.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
The ultimate insider scoop on the latest books, right here on Fully Booked. This is Fully Booked by Kirkus Reviews. Thanks for joining us.
So that was one list that Kirkus has recently published. But as you know, every week we ask our editors to look at the bestseller list and buzzy books that people are talking about to let us know what they really think and whether you should spend your time reading that book. So this week we've got our nonfiction editor, Eric Liebetrau, our young adult book editor, Laura Simeon, and our fiction editor, Laurie Muchnick, on the line, and we're going to see what they have to say. So, Laura, what are we liking in YA?
So, a book that's recently been on the bestseller list is The Dark Descent of Elizabeth Frankenstein by Kirsten White. And as you know, this is the bicentennial of Mary Shelley's Frankenstein, so it's very appropriate. And this story takes a character from the original book, Elizabeth Lavenza, who was the adopted sister and later wife of Victor Frankenstein. And she's at the center of this tale. She was this abused, neglected child who was brought into the Frankenstein home because she was the only one who could sort of calm Victor when he went into these rages. And at one point, he goes off to study. He's in Bavaria. He's incommunicado for some period of time. And Elizabeth goes off to find him and see what's going on and finds him in the middle of these kind of grisly experiments. So that's the setup for this book. And it goes into also the position of women at the time, how women were often dependent on men for their survival and how precarious this could be. So, yep. It's a good read.
Hey, Laura. I'm always fascinated by these retellings, and I just wonder if, you know, this would be a good entrance for young adult readers into the Frankenstein world, and especially Mary Shelley's version.
You know, I think it really would be. If someone had already read the original, they would understand a lot of the references in this book, but it's definitely not opaque. And I think it's a kind of book that would really pique readers' curiosity and make them want to seek out the original.
Okay, thanks.
Don't go anywhere, Eric. We are turning to nonfiction for your selection for the week.
Well, it's actually a good transition. Laura was talking about the place of women. I have a great book for our current situation. It's called Good and Mad, The Revolutionary Power of Women's Anger. And it's by Rebecca Traister, who's a writer at large for New York Magazine and a contributing editor at Elle. She wrote a book a couple years ago called All the Single Ladies that was a pretty big hit. And this one is an extremely angry book about women's anger.
Hell yeah.
Yeah. And given the, you know, ridiculous circus we saw with the Kavanaugh hearings and stuff, this book could not be more timely. And it's not, the great part about it is it's not just anger. As our reviewer said, is the goal is not anger for its own sake, but to access, acknowledge, express, and use it to rebuild structures. And I think it's a great, she goes into some history, but it's mostly about current events, about Trump and the election and the Me Too movement and systemic racism and other such topics. But I think it's extremely well documented, very well written. And I think it's also good if anybody has read or is about to read the book Rage Becomes Her, which just came out last month. This one is a perfect complement to that. And I think these kinds of books you really can't get enough of at this point.
I was so excited that I got to see her in an event the night before the book was published, speaking with Samantha Bee, which was like,
oh yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it was just amazing. It was like, you know, ground zero of angry women, I think.
Yeah. I think I saw your post on Facebook. I was quite jealous of that. I'm sure it was a fascinating conversation.
It was great. And I've been kind of following her tour on social media. She's been all around the country and, you know, in conversation with all kinds of amazing people. And she's still doing it. So people should look out for her wherever you are, I think.
Number one, I'm moving back to New York immediately. Number two, I ended up missing her event here at PALS in Portland, Oregon, and it made me very angry. So I am angrily enjoying her book currently, though. And it
you're right on brand.
You know? So I think you have to direct your anger at me, because as I recall, I think you had to turn in an article to me.
I think that was probably my fault somewhere in there.
Maybe like 25% your fault, 75% extremely mean editor.
You insist.
Yeah. Yeah. So, Laurie, what is going on in fiction?
Well, I have to admit that what I'm going to recommend this week, a book called The Lake on Fire by Rosellen Brown, is neither on the bestseller list nor probably something you would have heard of, except for me recommending it. But this is just my opportunity to, you know, plug one of my favorite writers who has a new book out that you might not hear about otherwise. Rosellen Brown she's a great novelist. She hasn't written a book in 18 years, I think. She was really well known at the time when her last book came out. She wrote a book called Before and After that was made into a movie with Meryl Streep and Liam Neeson. Another book called Half a Heart, and that was the last one. Her previous books were all kind of set in the contemporary world, and they always involve like really complicated, prickly relationships among like spouses and siblings and parents and children. And they usually had something to do with current issues, civil rights movement, various other things. And now this new book is completely different, yet also the same in that it's set in the late 1800s. It's a historical novel about a Jewish family that's immigrated to Wisconsin, and they're living on a farm, and it's kind of bleak. And so the daughter, Chaya, and the youngest son, Asher, who's like, I don't know, 8 or 10, he's kind of a genius, a weird prodigy. They take off and they go to Chicago. And Brown just incredibly recreates this whole world of, you know, 1890s Chicago. Chaya goes to work in a cigar factory, and you just feel like you're smelling the tobacco on your fingers. It's so intense. And of course, because she's working in a cigar factory, you're exposed to all of these issues of, you know, wealth and poverty. And Asher goes, and because he's so smart, he kind of works his way into accidentally working as kind of a sideshow act. Like, people would ask him any question and he would answer it. And he winds up at the Chicago Exposition of 1893. So there's a whole scene set in there. And it's just, and then Jane Addams rolls in and has a big part in the book. So it's just immersive and intelligent, and it's published by a real small press, Saraband, which does beautiful books, but perhaps is not, you know, the most, you know, this book isn't going to be in Walmart. You know, it's not going to be in front of everybody's faces. So seek it out, because I really recommend it very highly.
I love that publisher, by the way.
Yeah.
They do great books.
Yeah, I haven't read it, but the book itself is so beautiful.
Yes, they did a beautiful job. I love books with really nice spines, and it's just color, like this beautiful picture of the Chicago, and it's colorful. It's really nice.
And she knows what she's talking about. She's cracked a lot of spines.
Laurie, I love hearing about these kind of hidden gems. And so I just wanted to recommend a series that I think everyone in Sweden would know, but maybe not as well known in the U.S. And it's The Emigrants Quartet by Wilhelm Moberg, or Moberg in Swedish. And they're about emigrants from Sweden to the American Midwest in the second half of the 19th century. So kind of a similar time period and theme. And they've been translated into English and they're classics over there. They came out in the 1950s, but I don't think they're as well known in the U.S. And he did a lot of research, I think, in the Minnesota Historical Society and so on.
That sounds really good. I've never heard of him. Thank you, Laura.
Oh, you're welcome.
Well, thank you all. Those are some great choices. We hope you join us next week. We're going to be talking to Joseph Fink, who is the author of Alice Isn't Dead. And you may know Joseph Fink from the Welcome to Night Vale podcast. And in Alice Isn't Dead, a female big rig driver crisscrosses America searching for signs of the wife everyone else thinks is dead. And our critic calls it a terrifying new storytelling experience that affirms, even in our darkest moments, that love conquers all. So it's not going to leave you on the floor with existential despair. Until then, you know what to do. Turn this thing off and go read a book.
Thanks for listening to Fully Booked by Kirkus Reviews. Check out new episodes every Tuesday at PodcastOne.com, on the Podcast One app, or you can subscribe on iTunes.
Joseph Wurtenbaugh is the writing name of Frank Barry. Barry practiced law for 40 years in Silicon Valley. His latest novel, Thursday's Child, follows Adele Jansen, an up-and-coming lawyer whose whole trajectory shifts after a chance encounter. Our reviewer says, Wurtenbaugh delivers an absorbing tale about checkered pasts and new commitments. In this sponsored interview, we talk with Frank about his novel. Frank, welcome to Fully Booked.
Thank you, Karen.
Can you tell us about your wide-ranging law career?
Yes, I began after graduating from Berkeley as a public defender in 1971. Spent the 70s defending cases. In the 80s, I switched to tax and securities and ended up as an entrepreneurial where I did software companies in Silicon Valley. Hmm. Then that got old and I went back actually to criminal law. My first love is a prosecutor, assigned to do trade secrets for Silicon Valley. Mm-hmm. All of that background shows up in the novel.
Hmm. Can you tell us a little bit more about how that background appears in Thursday's Child?
Well, the heroine is an intellectual property lawyer. It's my latest novel, but also my first, because you're looking at a revised edition. I set it in 1989, mm-hmm. Just about the time I left that field. And a lot of the issues that have to do with computer science and so on occur as natural elements of the plot and so forth. She has to encounter problems and there's an elaborate subplot involving consolidation of, the internet didn't exist then, but what is going to become the internet and mm-hmm. so forth, as at the same time as she tries to figure out her personal life, which mm-hmm. becomes more and more challenging.
Right. And it also borrows from various myths, including the story of Cupid and Psyche. What drew you to Greek mythology and a quest for lost love?
Well, it wasn't Greek mythology as such. Actually, this is funny. I didn't identify the myth until I was halfway through the book. Mm-hmm. But in the book, Adele finds herself having a meaningful encounter. She's not a lightweight by any means, with a man that she knows she's can't make a future with, as fascinating as she finds the present. She unexpectedly finds herself with a need to find out more about him. And the plot has to do with how difficult that turns out to be. It turns out to be epic. Hmm. The conceit of the book, the fun of the book, is that I made Adele, who's attractive, as all romantic heroines are, but physically she's a rather smallish, 5'1", 2", the last person you would think would be a formidable person just to look at her. But yet the reality is she's super bright, super focused, and a fully armored warrior. Part of the fun of the book is watching her pull out these weapons one after another that she actually possesses, to unsuspecting people that have disregarded her. I find that appealing.
Mm-hmm. Well, Frank, thanks so much for talking with us about your book. If you're just joining the podcast, you can find Thursday's Child at Amazon.com.
Spectrum One is a big deal. You get Spectrum Internet with the most reliable internet speeds, free advanced Wi-Fi for enhanced security and privacy, and a free Spectrum Mobile Unlimited line with nationwide 5G included, all while saving big. For the big speed, big reliability, and big savings you want, get Spectrum One. Just $49.99 a month for 12 months. Visit spectrum.com/bigdeal for full details. Offer subject to change. Valid for qualified residential customers only. Service not available in all areas. Restrictions apply.
Sometimes it takes a different approach to help you unlock your true potential. With Capella University's game-changing FlexPath learning format, you gain relevant skills you can apply to your career right away. Earn your degree from an accredited university and be confident in the quality of your education. Imagine your future differently at capella.edu. Capella University is accredited by the Higher Learning Commission. Learn more at capella.edu/accreditation.